Fraud of Feminism, Part 7 by E. Belfort Bax. Feminist Lies and Fallacies. Another suffragist lie, which is invariably allowed to pass muster by default, save for an occasional protest by the present writer, is the assumption that the English law draws a distinction as regards prison treatment, etc., as between political and non-political offenders. Everyone, with even the most elementary legal knowledge, is aware that no such distinction has ever been recognised or suggested by the English law, at least until the prison ordinance made quite recently expressly to please the suffragettes by Mr. Winston Churchill, when Home Secretary. However desirable many may consider such a distinction to be, nothing is more indubitable than the fact that it has never previously obtained in the letter or practice of the law of England, and yet without a word of contradiction, from those who know better, arguments and protests galore have been fabricated on the suffragette side, based solely on this impudently false assumption. Misdemeanours and crimes at common law, when wilfully committed, have in all countries always remained misdemeanours and crimes, whatever motive can be conveniently put forward to account for them. A political offence has always meant the expression of opinions or the advocacy of measures or acts, not of the nature of common law crimes, which are in contravention of the existing law. For example, a libel on the constituted authorities of the state, or the forcible disregard of a law or police regulation in hindrance of the right of public speech or meeting. This is what is meant by political offence in any country recognising such as a special class of offence, entitling those committing it to special treatment. This is so where the matter refers to the internal legislation of the country. Where the question of extradition comes in, the definition of political offence is, of course, wider. Take the extreme case, that of the assassination of a ruler or functionary, especially in a despotic state, where free press and the free expression of opinion generally do not exist. This is undoubtedly a political, not a common law offence, insofar as other countries are concerned, that is. And hence, the perpetrator of such a deed has the right to claim immunity on this ground from extradition. The position assumable is that under despotic conditions, the progressive man is at war with the despot and those exercising authority under him. Therefore, in killing the despot or the repositories of despotic authority, he is striking directly at the enemy. It would, however, be absurd for the agent in a deed of this sort to expect special political treatment within the jurisdiction of the state itself immediately concerned. As a matter of fact, he never does so. Fancy a Russian nihilist, when brought to trial, whining that he is a political offender and hence to be exempted from all harsh treatment. No, the nihilist has too much self-respect to make himself ridiculous in this way. Hardly even the maddest terrorist anarchist would make such a claim. For example, the French law recognises the distinction between political and common law offences. But for all this, the band Tragique, Bonneau and his associates did not receive any benefit from the distinction or even claim to do so, though otherwise they were loud enough in proclaiming the political motives inspiring them. Even as regards extradition, running amok at large, setting fire promiscuously to private buildings, or injuring the ordinary non-political citizen as a protest, would not legally come into the category of political offences and hence protect their authors from being surrendered as ordinary criminals. The real fact, of course, is that all this talk on the part of suffragettes and their backers about political offences and political prison treatment is only a mean and underhanded way of trying to secure special sex privileges under false pretences. Those who talk the loudest in the strain in question know this perfectly well. These falsehoods are dangerous, in spite of what one would think ought to be their obvious character as such, by reason of the psychological fact that you only require to repeat a lie often enough, provided you are uncontradicted, in order for the aforesaid lie to be received as established truth by the mass of mankind, mostly fools, as Carlyle had it. It is a preposterous claim, I contend, that any misdemeanour and a fortiori, any felony, has, law apart, and even from a merely ethical point of view, any claim to special consideration and leniency on the bare declaration of the felon or misdemeanant that it has been dictated by political motive. In no country, at any time, has the mere assertion of political motive been held to bring an ordinary crime within the sphere of treatment of political offences? According to the legal and ethical logic of the suffragettes, it is perfectly open for them to set on fire theatres, churches, houses, and even to shoot down the harmless passer-by in the street and claim the treatment of first-class misdemeanours on the ground that the act was done as a protest against some political grievance under which they imagined themselves to be labouring. The absurdity of the suggestion is evident on its mere statement. And yet the above preposterous assumption has been suffered equally with the one last noted to pass, virtually without protest, and what is more serious, it has been acted upon by the authorities as though it were indubitably sound law, as well as sound ethics. It may be pointed out that what has cost many an Irish Fenian in the old days, and many a terrorist anarchist at a later date, a sentence of penal servitude for life, can be indulged in by modern suffragettes at the expense of a few weeks' imprisonment in the first or second division. Of course, this whole talk of political offences, when they are on the face of the mere common crimes, is purely and simply a trick designed to shield the cowardly and contemptible female creatures who perpetrate these senseless and dastardly outrages from the punishment they deserve and would receive if they had not the good fortune to be of the privileged sex. In the case of men, this impudent nonsense would, of course, never have been put forward, and if it had, it would have been summarily laughed out of court. That it should be necessary to point out these things in so many words is a striking illustration of the moral and intellectual atrophy produced by feminism in the public mind. There is another falsehood we often hear by way of condoning the infamous outrages of the suffragettes. The excuse is often offered, when the illogical pointlessness of the militant methods of the modern suffragettes are in question. Oh, men have also done the same things. Men have used violence to attain political ends. Now, the fallacy involved in this retort is plain enough. It may be perfectly true that men have used violence to attain their ends on occasion, but to assert this fact in the connection in question is purely irrelevant. There is violence, and there is violence. It is absolutely false to say that men have ever adopted purposeless and insane violence as a policy.
You're listening to Radio Stormer on thedailystormer.com.
There is another falsehood we often hear by way of condoning the infamous outrages of the suffragettes. The excuse is often offered, when the illogical pointlessness of the militant methods of the modern suffragettes are in question. Oh, men have also done the same things. Men have used violence to attain political ends. Now, the fallacy involved in this retort is plain enough. It may be perfectly true that men have used violence to attain their ends on occasion, but to assert this fact in the connection in question is purely irrelevant. There is violence, and there is violence. It is absolutely false to say that men have ever adopted purposeless and inane violence as a policy. The violence of men has always had an intelligible relation to the ends they had in view, either proximate or ultimate. They pulled down Hyde Park railings in 1866. Good. But why was this? Because they wanted to hold a meeting and found the park closed against them, the destruction of the railings being the only means of gaining access to the park. Again, the Reform Bill riots of 1831 were at least all directed against government property and governmental persons, that is, the enemy with whom they were at war. In most cases, as at Bristol and Nottingham, there was, as in that of the Hyde Park railings, a very definite and immediate object in the violence and destruction committed, namely, the release of persons imprisoned for the part they had taken in the reform movement by the destruction of the jails where they were confined. What conceivable analogy have these things with a policy of destroying private property, setting fire to tea pavilions, burning boat builders' stock in trade, destroying private houses, poisoning pet dogs, upsetting jockeys, defacing people's correspondence, including the postal orders of the poor, mutilating books in a college library, pictures in a public gallery, etc., etc. And all these, bien entendu, not openly, and in course of a riot, but furtively, in the pursuit of a deliberately premeditated policy. Have, I ask you, men ever, in the course of the world's history, committed mean, futile, and dastardly crimes such as these, in pursuit of any political or public end? There can be but one answer to this question. Every listener must know that there is no analogy whatsoever between suffragettes' militancy and the violence and crimes of which men may have been guilty. Even the terrorist anarchist, however wrong-headed he may be, and however much his deeds may be deemed morally reprehensible, is at least logical in his actions, insofar as the latter have always had some definite bearing on his political ends and were not merely senseless running amok. The utterly disconnected, meaningless and wanton character signalising the policy of the militant suffragettes would of itself suffice to furnish a conclusive argument for the incapacity of the female intellect to think logically or politically, and hence against the concession to women of public powers, political, judicial or otherwise.
You're tuned in to Radio Stormer on thedailystormer.com.
Another fallacy, analogous to the preceding, inasmuch as it seeks to counterbalance female defects and weaknesses by the false allegation of corresponding deficiencies in men, is the feminist retort sometimes heard when the question of hysteria in women is raised. Oh, men can also suffer from hysteria. This has been already dealt with in an earlier podcast, but for the sake of completing the list of prominent feminist fallacies, I restate it concisely here. Now, as we have seen, it is exceedingly doubtful whether this statement is true in any sense whatsoever. There are eminent authorities who would deny that men ever have true hysteria. There are others, of course again, who would extend the term hysteria so as to include every form of neurasthenic disturbance. The question is largely, with many persons who discuss the subject, one of terminology. It suffices here to cut short quibbling on this score. For the novice, let us drop the word hysteria and formulate the matter as follows. Women are frequently subject to a pathological mental condition, differing in different cases, but offering certain well-marked features in common, a condition which seldom, if ever, occurs in men. This I take to be an incontrovertible proposition based upon experience, which will be admitted by every impartial person. Now, the existence of the so-called hysterical man I have hitherto found to be attested on personal experience solely by certain feminist medical practitioners who allege that they have met with him in their consulting rooms. His existence is thus vouchsafed for, just as the reality of the sea serpent is vouchsafed for by certain sea captains or other ancient mariners. Far be it from me to impugn the ability, still less the integrity, of these worthy persons, but in either case I may have my doubts as to the accuracy of their observation or of their diagnosis. It may be that the sea serpent exists, and it may be that hysteria is at times discoverable in male persons. But while a conclusive proof of the discovery of a single sea serpent of the orthodox pattern would go far to justify the yarn of the ancient mariner, the proof of the occurrence, in an occasional case, of hysteria in men would not, by far, justify the implied contention that hysteria is not essentially a female malady. If hysterical men are as common a phenomenon as certain hard-pressed feminists would make out, what I want to know is, where are they? While we come upon symptoms which would be commonly attributed to hysteria in well-nigh every second or third woman of whose life we have any intimate knowledge, how often do we find in men symptoms in any way resembling these? In my own experience, I have come across but two cases of men giving indications of a temperament in any way analogous to that of the hysterical woman. After all, the experience of the average layman, and in this I contend my own is more or less typical, is more important in the case of a malady manifesting itself in symptoms obvious to common observation, such as the one we are considering, than that of the medical practitioner, who by reason of his profession would be especially likely to see cases, if there were any at all, however few they might be. The possibility, moreover, at least suggests itself, that the latter may often mistake for hysteria, using the word in the sense commonly applied to the symptoms presented by women, symptoms resulting from general neurasthenia, or even from purely extraneous causes, such as alcohol or drugs. That this is sometimes the case is hardly open to question. That the pathological mental symptoms referred to as prevalent in the female, whether we attribute them to hysteria or not, are rarely, if ever, found in the male sex, is an undoubted fact. The rose, it is said, is just as sweet by any other name, and whether we term these affections symptoms of hysteria, or we describe them as hysteria itself, or deny that they have anything to do with true hysteria, their existence and frequency in the female sex remains, nonetheless, a fact. No, whether some of the symptoms of hysteria, true or so-called, are occasionally to be found in men or not, every impartial person must admit that they are extremely rare, whereas regards certain pathological mental symptoms, common in women and popularly identified rightly or wrongly with hysteria, there is, I contend, little evidence of their occurring in men at all. Wriggle and prevaricate as they may, it is impossible for suffragettes and feminists to successfully evade the undoubted truth that the mentality of women is characterized constitutionally by a general instability, manifesting itself in pathological symptoms radically differing in nature and in frequency from any that obtain in men.
Tune in to Radio Stormer on thedailystormer.com.
Very conspicuous among the fallacies that have done yeoman service in the feminist movement is the assumption that women are constitutionally the weaker sex. This has also been discussed by us in the second and third podcast, but the latter may again be supplemented here by a few further remarks, so deeply rooted in this fallacy in public opinion. The reason of the unquestioned acceptance of the assumption is partly due to a confusion of two things under one name. The terms bodily strength and bodily weakness cover two distinct facts. The attribution of greater bodily weakness to the female sex than to the male undoubtedly expresses a truth. But no less does the attribution of greater bodily strength to the female than to the male sex equally express a truth. In size, weight, and muscular development, average man has an unquestionable and in most cases enormous advantage over average woman. It is in this sense that the bodily structure of the human female can, with some show of justice, be described as frail. On the other hand, as regards tenacity of life, recuperative power, and what we may term toughness of constitution, woman is without doubt considerably stronger than man. Now this vigour of constitution may, of course, also be described as bodily strength, and to this confusion, the assumption of the general frailty of the female bodily organism, as compared with the male, has acquired general currency in the popular mind. The most carefully controlled and reliable statistics of the Registrar General and other sources show the enormously greater mortality of men than of women at all ages and under all conditions of life. Under the age of 5, the evidence shows that 120 boys die to every 100 girls. In adult life, the Registrar General shows that diseases of the chest are the cause of nearly 40% or more deaths among men than among women. That violence and accident should be the occasion of 150% more deaths among men than women is accounted for, partly at least, by the greater exposure of men, although the enormous disparity would lead one to suspect that here also the inferior resisting power in the male constitution plays a not inconsiderable part in the result. The report of the medical officer to the local government board proves that between the ages of 55 and 65, there is a startling difference in numbers between the deaths of men and those of women. He then goes on to show the details for the year 1910. And men die a lot more than women of all diseases and all types, all conditions. Nervous system, heart, blood vessels, respiratory system, digestive system, kidneys, acute infections, and violent deaths. Various additional causes connected with the more active and anxious life of men, the greater strain to which they are subjected, their greater exposure alike to infection and to accident, may explain a certain percentage of the excessive death rate of the male population, as opposed to the female. Yet these explanations, even allowing the utmost possible latitude to them, really only touch the fringe of the difference, with a single exception of deaths from violence and accident above alluded to, where liability and exposure may account for a somewhat larger percentage. The great cause of the discrepancy remains, without doubt, the enormous greater potentiality of resistance, in other words, of constitutional strength, in the female bodily organism as compared with the male.